From the campus of Brigham Young University in Provo, the Utah Debate Commission welcomes you to the Utah Senate Candidates Debate.
Pleased to have been invited by the Utah Debate Commission to moderate this debate. We are live in the KBYU studios on the campus of Brigham Young University in Provo for a debate between candidates for the United States Senate. Tonight we will hear from the incumbent, Republican Mike Lee, and from his Democratic challenger, Misty Snow. We begin with each candidate making a 90-second opening statement. Prior to the start of the debate, it was determined that Misty Snow will speak first. Ms. Snow.
All right, thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank the Utah Debate Commission for hosting this debate, and I'd like to thank all of you for watching this evening. My name is Misty K. Snow. I was born right here in the state of Utah and have lived my entire life here in the state of Utah. I have a deep connection to the state and to its people, and a deep appreciation for the history and culture of this state. I am 31 years old. If I'm elected to the U.S. Senate, I'll be the very first millennial in the U.S. Senate, making me a voice for my generation. I work at a grocery store. I am a working class person who understands the needs of working class people and their families. I understand what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck. I understand what average people all across the nation are going through on a day-to-day basis. Many people throughout the country feels that Congress is out of touch and no longer represents them. I believe if we want a government that truly represents working class people, we need to elect more working class people to government. As your senator, I will fight to ensure that our workers have a living wage. I will fight to ensure that our children have clean air to breathe and clean water to drink. I want to ensure that our mothers have paid maternity leave and that our women are paid equally. I want to fight to get money out of politics. I am not a career politician. I am not a Washington insider. I am someone who's never even been to Washington. I am someone who will be a new voice in Congress, a fresh voice, a voice that is needed, a voice that is currently underrepresented, a voice that will truly represent working class people in this country.
Thank you, Senator Snow. Senator Lee.
Thank you, Dr. Magleby. And I also want to thank the Debate Commission for putting this together, and I want to thank BYU for hosting this event. I have to say it's really good to be back. When I ran for the Senate for the first time in 2010, I promised to be a different kind of senator, and I made two promises. First, I promised that I would fight every day to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against an increasingly dysfunctional status quo in Washington. Second, I also promised not only to oppose bad ideas, but also to propose good ideas, better ideas. I've kept these promises. Over the last 6 years, I've fought every single day against Washington's dysfunctional status quo in all three branches of government. Over the years, I've helped to ban earmarks, to overturn President Obama's unconstitutional recess appointments, and to end once and for all Washington's warrantless surveillance against U.S. citizens. And I've also worked with Democrats and Republicans, with liberals and conservatives, to develop a new reform agenda, an agenda with big ideas to help working class families, big ideas including creating new jobs, growing wages, and expanding opportunity for all Americans, especially those families and those communities Washington's status quo has left behind. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. I look forward to our discussion tonight.
Thank you, Senator Lee. The Utah Debate Commission has established a format that allows each candidate 90 seconds for that initial response to a question. Questions for tonight's debate come from students and individuals who submitted their questions to the Utah Debate Commission website. I'll begin with this question submitted by Haley Winterton, and it goes to Ms. Snow first. She says, the least involved group in politics is college-age students, and probably the most important issue to most of them is being able to afford their education. What will you do to make college more affordable?
Obviously, as somebody who is a millennial, this is an issue I actually care a lot about, because this is an issue that has a big effect on my generation. many people in my generation, they go to college, they find that college is almost unaffordable. A lot of people, they do actually have been skipping going to college because they've determined the costs are not worth it. They know that if they go to college, they might get their degree, but they will leave college with tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And I find that unacceptable. We need to make college affordable. We need to make it accessible. Our nation benefits from a more educated populace. What I think we should do is try to make the student loans, let's give them a lower interest rate. Why is the federal government currently trying to make money off the backs of our students? We're charging near about 6% interest on student loans, while we're giving banks loans for near zero interest rates. Why can't we give our students the same deal? Furthermore, we certainly have a lot of grants and stuff available for students who want to go to college. It costs the federal government about $63 billion a year. But another report showed that we could actually make state universities tuition free for about a cost of $75 billion a year. It would be about a difference about $12 billion. I think that might be a better plan that would actually make college more affordable and more accessible to people who want to be able to choose the careers they want instead of be forced into one.
Senator Lee, your response to this question.
Ms. Snow and I agree in many respects on higher education. I certainly agree, for example, that we're better off as a country when we have well-educated citizens. We end up with a bigger, better tax base, and everyone prospers when they have access to an affordable, high-quality education. I also completely agree the federal government should not be in the business of making money off of the spread between the rate at which the government borrows and the rate it charges students. It's my belief the federal government ought not be in the business of commandeering the student loan industry in the first place. Look, the fact is, we've created a dynamic that has resulted in tuition hikes. We've got the federal government and the U.S. Department of Education, the accrediting bodies, and the institutions of higher learning, which collectively restrict entry into this industry. When you restrict entry and simultaneously subsidize people gaining access to the services offered in that industry, you hike prices. What we need is to increase competition in this field, a field where competition is so badly lacking. That's why I've introduced the Higher Education Reform Opportunity Act that has as its purpose creating more competition in higher education, allowing the states to accredit on their own so that alternative providers of a higher education learning experience, whether it's MOOCs, massive open online courses, or professional certifications, apprenticeship programs, or otherwise, can also participate. One thing we know about increasing competition: two things always happen when you do it. Prices tend to go down and quality tends to go up. That's what my bill would do.
I'm gonna ask a quick follow-up question. You agree on much of this, but the follow-up is, in light of especially what Senator Lee just said, how do you view for-profit education, which has experienced some controversy with some of them having to be closed? What would you do about the for-profit sector of higher education? Ms. Snow.
Obviously, the for-profit colleges, they are less affordable because they're trying to make a profit. And I think we need to, again, when we're talking about accreditation, I think trying to loosen accreditation standards isn't a good idea because we don't want these for-profit colleges to be considered equal to actual respected institution like Brigham Young University. We want to have standards, and I think it's important that the people who are going to college, the education is actually worth the money they're paying.
Senator Lee.
The fact that some for-profit schools are bad doesn't mean they're all bad. So too with nonprofits. The fact that there are a whole lot of nonprofit schools that are good doesn't mean they're all good. And I think each school needs to be evaluated on the basis of its results. By their fruits, you shall know them. And that's true, as true in higher education as it is anywhere else. And so I think what we need to do is encourage competition. And that'll help bring quality up and tuition down.
The next question comes from, I believe, Andy Cupp, a student at Brigham Young University. Andy?
So I'd like to know what specific actions and legislation you would take to address the issue of climate change if you're elected to office.
Senator Lee first on this question.
A big debate in our society about climate change. There can be no dispute that the climate is changing. Climates change. It's what they do. They always have, and they always will. Some of the greatest debates surround whether and in what way, to what extent, human beings are responsible for the change in climate. And even more critically, what, if anything, we can do to change that. What I struggle with the most with this question is that every proposal that I've heard of that would try to put the government in the middle of this and try to have the government fix it would do little or nothing to affect climate change, but would simultaneously threaten to devastate the economy. As President Obama himself admitted just a few years ago, if we adopted cap and trade, if we adopted any of the proposals that I'm aware of, it would cause energy prices necessarily to skyrocket. Let's think about what that means for a minute. That is effectively a backdoor, invisible tax increase on the poor. It's the most regressive type of expense hike you can imagine. This disproportionately affects poor and middle-class Americans who would be stuck paying higher prices on everything they buy and would also pay for it with diminished wages, unemployment, and underemployment. The best way we can get to a cleaner environment, one where we have greater efficiencies and fewer greenhouse gas emissions, is through innovation. Innovation is most likely to happen when we allow our free market economy to prosper. People will build a better mousetrap and a better car and a better power plant if we have a free market economy in place.
Ms. Snow.
So thank you very much for this question. The issue of climate change is a very important one. Despite what some of what Senator Lee said, climate change is real. But even if you don't believe climate change is real, here in the state of Utah, we have a problem with air quality. Polling shows that no state is more dissatisfied with its air quality than Utah. And a lot of the solutions to prevent climate change are a lot of the same solutions that are needed to reduce air pollution. So what I would like to propose is that our country starts making investments into cleaner energy, such as solar, such as wind, also greener transportation structure. That the cost of not doing this is, of course, negative impacts on the health of our citizens, especially our elderly, our children, our pregnant mothers, and there are economic costs to those health problems. It leads to shorter lifespans, leads to them spending a lot of money on healthcare costs that they would otherwise be able to spend elsewhere. So the cost of not doing something, I think, is too high. And I don't think it would cost too much to start making these investments. Here in the state of Utah, we actually raise the price of a gasoline tax by about 5 cents a gallon. Per gallon in the state of Utah. Most people in the audience probably didn't know that until I just mentioned it. It was well absorbed by the economy, and most people didn't know. So we could do something like that nationwide, maybe a small tax, 5 cents per gallon nationwide, be well absorbed by the economy, and that money could be used to start making investments into solar, into wind, into greener transportation infrastructure. It is very necessary we make these investments, because the price of not doing it is, I think, too high on the cost of our health and our future.
You've engaged each other on this question, so I'm going to invite a rebuttal, but I'd like to focus it a little bit. And the question, as worded by Andy, was, what's the role of government in legislation or regulation? So to each of you, what is the role of government in fostering innovation, which you mentioned, Senator Lee? And are there specific roles for government that you think ought to be in bounds? And in what ways do you disagree with Senator Lee's position? Senator Lee first.
There certainly is a role for government, a very important role to play. Government does set and needs to continue setting limits for emissions. In the case of Utah, one of the things we struggle with is ozone. And one of the problems that we have is that we've got these one-size-fits-all rules that apply to broad swaths of the country, when we've got unique geography here that might make our situation a little bit difficult. And that's one of the reasons why I've supported legislation that would create increased flexibility on the part of the states so that they can address those geographic unique aspects of our state.
Ms. Snow.
Well, obviously, it's like the federal government can play a very constructive role. As I said, we can start making investments into solar, into wind. And again, when you talk about economics, we talk about jobs. There's a lot of jobs to be created in these industries. Solar energy is actually one of the fastest growing industries in this country. And the government trying to help make investments in these industries will create new jobs in those fields, and that will help spur economic growth.
Great. Let's go to the next question. It's from McCade Claypool, a student.
It seems that both Congress and the nation are increasingly polarized and dismissive or even hostile towards each other. Americans have become less and less confident in Congress's ability to make laws due to widespread gridlock in both houses. Will you compromise with your opposition to pass laws?
Ms. Snow.
I think there's a lot of issues that resonate with a majority of people. There's been a number of laws that have actually passed with wide bipartisan support, and I don't think just because there's on certain issues that you can't find agreement on, there are certainly a lot of issues where you can find agreement on. There's a lot of critical issues that I think are very popular, such as like the need for like paid maternity leave. It's a popular issue. United States of America is just one of two countries in the entire world, along with Papua New Guinea, that is confirmed to not offer its mothers paid maternity leave. A 2012 poll showed that 86% of people in this country support guaranteed paid maternity leave for mothers, including 73% of Republicans. It's a popular issue, and it's a popular issue precisely because everybody has a mother, everybody knows somebody's given birth, and I think we could finally ensure that our mothers in this country have access to paid maternity leave like every other country. And it really just takes some people in Congress to actually draft legislation to advocate for it. And I think we could probably pass a bill like that with wide bipartisan agreement, because it is a issue I think resonates with a lot of people, especially coming from a state like Utah, which does have the nation's highest birth rate. On a number of other issues, we saw like countless bills pass, like 90% of the Senate in agreement, and I think we can still do that. Sure, there might be some disagreements on certain issues, but on other issues, I think there is a lot of agreement to be found.
Senator Lee.
There are, as Ms. Snow correctly notes, a lot of areas on which the parties are deadlocked. They're just irreconcilably in conflict. And they're doing this not just to be obstinate. They're doing this because the people themselves that they represent have different opinions. People across this country have a somewhat different vision. But Ms. Snow is correct also in pointing out there are a lot of other areas where that's not the case. And this is one of my favorite parts about being a senator. I'm constantly looking for areas where we can find bipartisan agreement. It's one of the reasons why a few years ago I was really troubled by the fact that the federal government, through the NSA, was collecting data on your phone calls, everyone's phone calls, the phone calls of every single American. They knew who you called, who called you, when you talked, and how long you spoke. And they kept it in a database for 5 years at a time. This bothered me. So I started looking for allies. I found an ally in my friend Pat Leahy. Now, Pat Leahy is a liberal Democrat from Vermont, and I'm very rarely described that way. He and I put together a bipartisan compromise, a solution to this called the USA Freedom Act. Initially, the members of my party, the Republican Party, were very reluctant to go along with this. The Democrats were overwhelmingly supportive, but eventually we got it passed. With almost all the Democrats and about half the Republicans in the Senate voting for it, and President Obama signed it into law. This is a good example of where this kind of compromise is possible.
Let's go to the next question. I think you're largely in agreement, and I think I heard you both say you'd be willing to compromise with someone from the other party, so there's no reason to prolong it. Rachel Osterloh has our next question.
Some Republican leaders have advocated a total shutdown of Islamic immigration or shutting down immigration from dangerous areas. What are your views on this policy?
And this one goes to Senator Lee first.
As a religious minority myself, as a descendant of people who were ordered exterminated by the governor of Missouri on October 27, 1838, I am strongly against any kind of religious test. We should shun any kind of an approach that says if you belong to religion X or if you believe in religious belief Y, you can't come here or you lose access to this or that. And so I think we've got to push back against that any time it happens. I also think that any time we're talking about who we're going to allow into this country, whether it's for humanitarian reasons, for economic reasons, for work-related reasons, we've got to be careful that we know who it is that we're letting in. We have a good idea of whether or not they have the potential to be good U.S. citizens, to fit in well here, to abide by our values, to respect their fellow Americans. And so I think every time we take someone in, particularly when taking refugees from a war-torn country like Syria, we got to make sure that we have procedures in place to make sure that we know who we're taking in. This is especially difficult with Syria, because in this case of Syria, they have no established, reliable record-keeping system. To the extent they had one before the current civil war, it's been badly damaged and weakened. And so we're going to have to undertake an extra cautious effort to make sure that we have something to back that up so that we know who's coming in.
Ms. Snow.
I kind of agree with much of what Mike Lee said about religion. I don't think we should be favoring immigrants or refugees of one religion over another. It's very, I think, antithetical to the values of our nation. As it says in the First Amendment, we shall not establish or favor one religion over another. or favor establishment of one religion over another, and I think that should apply to when we're talking about our immigration policies as well. This is something that requires a lot of compassion. People are coming from Syria or Iraq or anywhere else. These people are trying to escape a bad situation. They're trying to escape a war. They're trying to escape poverty. In many cases, certain death from a lot of the war that is happening there. There's a lot of different forces, like from ISIS and other groups unaffiliated with them that are at war with each other. And there's a lot of innocent people just caught in the middle of that. And I think as a nation, we should show these people compassion. I think it's okay to accept refugees from Syria and elsewhere. The United States of America does have one of the most stringent vetting processes of any nation in the world when it comes to taking in refugees to our nation, and their religion should not matter. Our Constitution protects the rights of all people to practice their religion, regardless of what it is, and people of all faiths, I think, add to the great diversity of our nation. It is what makes our nation what it is.
If I'm hearing you, you largely agree with each other in terms of the principle, but there may be some disagreement on the vetting process, so a quick follow-up question. Are you confident the vetting process works, perhaps in cases other than Syria? And secondarily, would you support Donald Trump's position of a across-the-board prohibition for Muslims? Senator Lee first.
The second part of the question, no, heck no, absolutely not, never. That's a religious
test.
That
was a waist-high fastball, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I can't ever support that. The other part of your question assumes we're talking about countries other than Syria.
Yes.
I think, generally speaking, we do a decent job in vetting people who come here as refugees. Syria is a notable exception, and one of the reasons why we need to focus on Syria is because we know that ISIS is manipulating refugee programs in Western countries to carry out terrorist activity. We can't let that happen.
Ms. Snow, the question about vetting, but also where you would stand on Mr. Trump's proposal.
I also agree that Donald Trump is very wrong on that issue, and that religious tests, I mean, that's, again, antithetical to our values. Obviously, Syria is problematic, but the vetting process is pretty stringent. If there is, for whatever reason, we have concerns, I trust our immigration services to catch them. I trust our security services to catch them. I have a lot of confidence in our government on this issue because it has been proven to be very effective. We've had very few problems with refugees coming into this nation from Syria or elsewhere.
Thank you for your answers. The next question is from Orlo Iyer. Orlo?
Yes, most Americans are concerned about gun violence in their communities. With the ever-increasing rash of mass shootings, many polls indicate a majority of Americans favor tighter gun control laws. Without denying Second Amendment rights for sportsmen and individuals seeking self-defense, and in the spirit of bipartisan compromise, what can be done in Congress to address this problem?
Ms. Snow.
Yeah, obviously, this is a huge issue. We have seen several mass shootings over the last year, including one of the worst in our nation's history in Orlando back in June. So I think what we need to do, when we talk about polling, a poll from August in the state of Utah from Public Policy Polling showed that 81% of Utahns want universal background checks on all gun purchases, and 78% of Utahns would like to see people on the terrorist watch list banned from purchasing firearms. These are obviously popular ideas, and because they're popular, I think we could get some bipartisan support on that. Obviously, there might be some issues with how the terrorist watch list is structured, but I think it does give us a good idea on what the public wants on how to move forward on this issue. I think we can find a way to balance the legitimate safety needs of our citizens without violating their constitutional rights. On the flip side, why we are allowing people on terrorist watch list to buy firearms, we're currently banning people who use, say, marijuana in accordance with their state law, like a case out of California, from being able to buy firearms. So I think it's a bit of inconsistency in that we're banning people who use cannabis in accordance with their state law from buying firearms, but we're okay with allowing people who are on terrorist watch list from buying firearms. And I haven't seen a lot of leadership from Mike Lee on this issue. I would like to see him for support ending the federal prohibition of marijuana and protect the rights of legal cannabis users to own firearms.
Senator Lee.
I agree that we shouldn't let terrorists get guns. I agree also that we shouldn't let convicted felons have access to guns. And I recognize the fact that polling data often results in numbers like those that you cited. We do have to remember that what we vote on in Congress are not polling questions. They're legislation. We have to read the actual bill. About 3 years ago, there was a big push for a gun control measure authored by a couple of my colleagues. People in the media and people around town in Washington were predicting that this would pass, it would pass overwhelmingly, that it would be signed into law by the president and nothing would change it. Curiously, you had many, if not most, members of the United States Senate signing onto this legislation before it had even been written. True story. This happens sometimes. I remember the Friday when the legislation was finally released. It had 50 or 60 co-sponsors already, but no one had read it because it didn't yet exist. When it was finally released, I spent the weekend reviewing it. It's a habit of mine. I'd like to read bills before I vote on them. And what I discovered was that this bill would do little or nothing at all to stop violent crime. What it would do was dramatically restrict those who are already law-abiding citizens. So every time I review gun control legislation, I review it with an eye toward, as you said, respecting the Second Amendment and also respecting the rights of the law-abiding, and comparing that to what it would do, if anything, to protect Americans from violent crime.
A quick follow-up with each of you on this. Senator Lee, Ms. Snow mentioned something about cannabis, which is legal in some places but would prohibit them getting firearms. A response on that particular question. And for Ms. Snow, I think a question on assault weapons and other kinds of weapons that you think may be worthy of some prohibitions, if any.
Just Senator, to be clear, you're asking me about the legalization of marijuana.
Legalization of marijuana as it is also linked to the ability to acquire firearms.
Okay. This brings up some very interesting topics. If we were starting as a matter of first principles, I think it would make the most sense to allow states the option of deciding what medical treatments are appropriate and legal within that state, rather than having that decision made by government bureaucrats in Washington. It is not the system of laws that we have currently in place. We do currently have a nationwide federal criminal ban on a number of things, including marijuana. And so there is a debate on this. It's a debate that warrants further study. But as a matter of first principles, I think states ought to be able to have the right to decide what treatments can benefit people in that state so that people don't have to wait for years at a time pending FDA approval.
Ms. Snow.
Yeah, I actually don't have any issues necessarily assault rifles. I think we should try to work with like universal background checks and maybe restricting certain violent people from being able to buy firearms first, see where that gets us before we talk about banning certain types of firearms. I'm not interested in really taking people's guns away. And it's also why I care so much about ending the federal prohibition of marijuana. I think it's created this issue where most states already have cannabis legal for medicinal purposes, including right here in the state of Utah, where we have cannabis oil legal for the treatment of epilepsy. And I find it problematic that a lot of people who are using marijuana in accordance with their state laws are now running into issues where they can no longer own firearms.
I mean, to thank you both. We got a twofer there. We got two questions for the time of one. And we now near the midpoint of our time tonight. I welcome you once again to this debate between Misty Snow and Mike Lee, candidates for the United States Senate. You are joining us live on the campus of Brigham Young University in Provo. This debate and others held in 2014 and 2016 are the result of a group of citizens and media outlets joining together to broadcast statewide a series of exchanges between candidates for statewide and federal office. Questions for this debate were submitted in advance at the Utah Debate Commission website, utahdebatecommission.org. The aim is to better inform you, the voter, about the candidates. Now back to the questions. And the next question goes to Kim Anderson. This will go to Senator Lee first.
Senator Lee, what is the proper balance between religious liberties and the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender citizens? Are we near the balance now? And if not, what would you advocate?
Thank you very much for your question, Kim. This is an important issue today. It's important to understand that there are two different types of discrimination that we sometimes see in our society. One type of discrimination we might call private is what happens when two individuals interact. Another type, which we might call public discrimination, is when government itself discriminates against its own disfavored citizens based on some characteristic disfavored by those in power. Both forms of discrimination can be deadly and ugly and some of the worst things that we see, but between the two, public discrimination is perhaps the most dangerous. It undoubtedly is, for the simple reason that when government is disfavoring people based on their characteristics that government doesn't like, people don't have any choice. They can't not interact with their government. There is, moreover, a disparity in their power, in their ability to resist, because government, particularly the federal government, operates with overpowering force. It's what governments do. It's why they exist in the first place. So that's why I think we've got to be very careful whenever government starts to discriminate on the basis of a disfavored religious belief. I'm fully convinced that LGBT rights and religious liberties can thrive in the same environment. And what the government needs to do is take a position of non-discrimination. It's not going to discriminate against people on the basis of their religious beliefs, and it's going to treat all citizens, regardless of their race or regardless of their sexual orientation, with dignity and compassion and respect.
Ms. Snow.
Absolutely. I do believe that all people deserve equal protection under the law, as it states in the 14th Amendment, and that extends to LGBT people. The balance of religious rights and rights of minorities is that people have the right to believe in whatever religion they want, believe in whatever god or goddess or goddess gods they want. They believe they have the right to worship how they want, and that is a great cherished value of our nation. At the same time, you cannot use those rights to supersede the rights of others. Religious rights, like all rights, end where the rights of other individuals begin. Like, just as you cannot yell fire in a crowded theater, you cannot use your religion as an excuse to discriminate against someone. The Supreme Court has ruled that a business, for example, cannot discriminate against an interracial couple based on their religion, and as per the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, they should not be able to discriminate against a same-sex couple for the same reason. Obviously, I think it is possible to balance all rights of people, because I don't think it's a problem to say you need to treat all, if you own a business, you need to treat all customers equally. You need to treat as you would treat any other. You shouldn't favor some customers over another. You shouldn't be able to serve, say, only Christians. You shouldn't be able to serve only white people, and you shouldn't be able to only serve straight cis people. That is, I think most people agree with that. You need to show equal treatment and show love and compassion to all people. And as a senator, I will absolutely support the equal rights for LGBT people without exception.
Thank you for your answers. Would either of you like time for a rebuttal, or should we move to the next question?
I'd like to respond.
Fine.
I've introduced a bill called the First Amendment Defense Act, the purpose of which is to prohibit the federal government or any of its agencies or departments from discriminating against any religious institution or individual based on a religious belief about marriage. Regardless of what your religious beliefs about marriage are, and regardless of what your neighbor might believe from a religious standpoint about marriage, neither you nor your neighbor should ever be discriminated against by government based on that belief.
A response or?
Yes, absolutely. The problem with bills like the First Amendment Defense Act is that it allows, pretty much legalizes the discrimination in the name of religion. Let's say you have a hospital that is owned by like the Catholic Church. It would be wrong for the hospital to be able to discriminate against somebody who needs life-saving medical care just because they're LGBT. There has been issues where back in, I want to say the year 2000, there was a man named Robert Eds. He was a transgender man. He had ovarian cancer. He was denied access at 13 different hospitals on the basis that he was trans, and then he died from his condition because he was not able to get medical care due to discrimination by private hospitals.
Thank you for those responses.
Dr. Magley, I'd like to respond to that if I could.
Okay, about 10-second response
sure,
on each.
Sure. If you take a look at the First Amendment Defense Act, it does not cover what you describe. What we're talking about here is protecting religious individuals and institutions like BYU so that their tax-exempt status cannot be denied and so that no other adverse action can be taken against them based on their religious beliefs.
10 seconds as well.
I would encourage religious institutions like BYU or any other to treat all students equally, regardless of whether or not they're LGBT. I think that is the loving, humane, compassionate thing to do.
Let's go to the next question from I'll invite you to hold your applause, please. Let's go to the next question. Blake Ringer, and this one goes to Misty Snow first.
We often loom on the precipice of government shutdowns because we cannot pass a budget. Senator Lee, you were a supporter of shutting down the government in 2013. Under what circumstances would you support shutting down the government if reelected? And to Ms. Snow, under what circumstances, if any, would you support shutting down the government?
Ms. Snow first.
I don't think Congress should shut down the government. The Congress has a job to govern. They have a job to pass the budget. That government shutdown of 2013 that Mike Lee was a huge part of, I think was a shameful part on our nation's history. And it was really about trying to, whether or not we should give health care to our citizens, which And Mike Lee and the other Republicans really didn't offer an alternative to the Affordable Care Act. They just feel that the Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional, but of course, Supreme Court later ruled that the Affordable Care Act is in fact constitutional. Why the government was shut down, the state of Utah lost about $30 million, according to Governor Herbert's office, and the federal government is the largest employer in the state of Utah, employing about 35,000 people. During the government shutdown, those people were out of work, they didn't know when their next paycheck would be, and a lot of people who live with them, their families, their children, they were struggling because they weren't sure how they were, if they were ever gonna see a paycheck anytime soon. And furthermore, it didn't just hurt the public employees. State of Utah, we have 5 national parks, we have multiple national monuments, we have millions of acres of other public lands that bring a lot of tourism to the state. A lot of communities that depend on the national park, especially when you go down places like Moab, down to Torrey, even like places like Cedar City, they depend on a lot of tourism into their communities. Tourism is the lifeblood of those communities. During the government shutdown, people weren't coming to their hotels, people weren't coming to their restaurants, people weren't buying stuff at their gift shops, and that really hurt those communities. And I think shutting down the government is no way to lead, and I would do everything I can to keep government working for the people as I was sent there to do.
Senator Lee.
Shutting down the government is bad. Let me tell you what really happened in 2013. Halfway through 2013, we learned that President Obama had rewritten 4 key provisions of Obamacare. He did this without statutory authority, without any authority under the Constitution. He said it was necessary because, as he explained it, Obamacare was not ready to be implemented as written. Based on that explanation, I and other members of the House and other members of the Senate said, well, if it's not ready to be implemented, let's not fund its implementation. It was set to kick in fully on January 1st of 2014. What we proposed was that we delay funding, that we not fund it for that first year because President Obama said it wasn't ready. By the way, we know now what he meant when he said it wasn't ready. We know now that people have seen premium increases year after year, and just recently one of Utah's largest health insurers announced yet another increase, this one a 40% premium increase that will hit ratepayers next year. What we suggested was that we have at least 2 votes to fund the government. It's one of the big problems with Washington. They push all the spending decisions into one bill on one day, very often with only a few hours or a few days to go. We said let's have at least 2 votes. There ought to be more than that, really. But let's have at least 2 votes. Let's have 1 vote on whether to fund Obamacare. Let it stand on its own. Let's have another vote on funding for everything else in the government. President Obama said no. Unless you're willing to fund everything in government, including Obamacare, which he said wasn't ready to be implemented, I won't let you fund anything. Not veterans benefits, not national parks, nothing else. President Obama shut down the government. You've been told otherwise by the media, but they are wrong.
A response, Ms. Snow?
Yes. So the government was shut down. I think they should have done more. I think the Senate could have done more to prevent that. And I don't think it's all Obama's fault. The Senate does create bills. They do put provisions, a lot of provisions into single bills. But shutting down the government was such an extreme response to that. And we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act has been very good and reducing the number of people who are uninsured in this country, had very good consumer protections that allow people to have health insurance without being denied because of pre-existing conditions. Obviously, we need to do a lot more to ensure that everybody has access to health care, but obviously it's a complex topic we can't talk about in 90 seconds.
A rebuttal, Senator Lee.
It's a huge problem in Washington. It's a little bit like what you might experience if you lived in an outlying area. You were on your way home from work. There was only one grocery store for miles around. Your spouse calls you, says, bring home bread, milk, and eggs. You get to the counter with your bread, your milk, and your eggs, and the cashier says to you, I'm sorry, I can't sell you those items unless you also buy a bucket of nails and a half ton of iron ore, and a book about cowboy poetry, and a Barry Manilow album. And you say, I don't even like Barry Manilow. And they say, too bad. Unless you buy one of all these items, in fact, one of every item in the store, you can't buy anything. This is how Washington has been funding itself. This is wrong, and it has to stop.
The next question I'll pose for both Senator Lee and Ms. Snow. Some senators have held open the possibility of moving on a vote to confirm Merrick Garland for the United States Supreme Court before the new president is sworn in January. Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said the newly elected president should name that next justice, Justice Scalia's replacement. If elected, would you vote to confirm Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court? Why or why not? And who would you include on your short list for U.S. Supreme Court justices and why? Senator Lee first.
Every time people talk about the Supreme Court vacancy, it is currently open, those who want Judge Garland confirmed as Justice Garland are often using the talking point that the Senate needs to do its job, the Senate needs to act. Well, the Senate does act. The Senate acts anytime the president nominates someone requiring Senate confirmation. The Senate acts in some cases by holding hearings, holding votes, and voting the person up, meaning confirming the person. The Senate can also do that when it votes the person down. The Senate also acts, and the Senate speaks, when it chooses not to hold hearings or votes, because that's the same result as voting the person down. This is the Senate's prerogative, and it's a prerogative taken very seriously, because the Senate is a political body, and it's put into the appointment process for a reason. It's a reason that's become increasingly important in recent years, because the Supreme Court of the United States has started involving itself in the process of deciding all kinds of issues that are hotly debated matters of public policy. And it's decided issues ranging from the sanctity of unborn human life to the definition of marriage and everything else in between. So with that politicization of the Supreme Court of the United States, it shouldn't be surprising to us that the United States Senate has chosen to exercise its power and to allow the next president of the United States to fill this vacancy left by the late Justice Antonin Scalia.
Ms. Snow.
Many Utahns would feel that Mike Lee is not doing his job. A public policy poll from August showed that 65% of Utahns want Merrick Garland to have a hearing. And if for whatever reason Mike Lee doesn't think he's a good justice, he can ask him questions. And if he's not satisfied, he can vote him down and force Obama to nominate another justice who he would be more comfortable with. That is how the process is supposed to work. And I think it is shameful that every day our nation is setting a new record for the longest vacancy in the history of our nation on the Supreme Court. As a U.S. senator, I would be willing to give Merrick Garland a hearing, or whoever else the sitting president nominates. I'd give him a fair hearing and vote them up or down based on the merits. I think that is what the Senate is supposed to do. That is what polling shows a majority of citizens across this nation want, including a majority of Utahns. It's a simple, also an issue where having vacancies on the court prevents courts from working as effectively. Since Scalia's death, we've had a number of 4-4 decisions, which have, in effect, allowed lower court rulings to stand. And saying it's a political court in recent years, it's not. They've always decided important issues facing the nation. You can go back to the 19th century. You can go back to even early parts of the 20th century. They've always ruled on the constitutionality of laws. And I think that is their purpose. And I think the Senate needs to work to confirm that nominee to fill that vacancy as soon as possible.
Rebuttal, but with a quick follow-up, how long would you allow such a period to go without a hearing or a vote if you are willing to say that the Senate is acting by not acting? And under what circumstances would you support a nominee from an opposing party that you disagreed with? You would still bring it to a vote. It is a question I'd like to follow up with you on, Ms. Snow. Senator Lee.
Okay. The question of deciding when to bring it up for a vote is really the decision of the majority leader. And so that's going to be up either to Mitch McConnell or to Chuck Schumer in the next Congress, not up to me. And I want to be very clear about one thing with Judge Garland. It is an open secret. It is a well-known fact that if Judge Garland were confirmed, Judge Garland would predictably, reliably, vote with the block of justices that includes Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor. If you like the far-left agenda pushed by those justices, then you would want to confirm Judge Garland. If not, you might feel differently.
Ms. Snow.
I disagree that Judge Garland would be as liberal as Mike Lee says. When he was approved to lower courts, he has spoken of very highly by Senator Orrin Hatch because he is a fairly moderate justice, and he's probably the most conservative justice that a Democratic president has nominated in recent years. What would get me to support a nominee of an opposing party? It really just depends on how they answer certain questions. I think the most important issue would be a justice who's willing to overturn Citizens United. Obviously, in the past, we have had justices confirmed with bipartisan support, and I actually believe Justice Scalia was confirmed unanimously by Senate, so it is possible to have bipartisan consensus appointments.
Let's go to the next question. It's from Sam Williams, and this question will first go to Ms. Snow.
If brought to a vote, will you support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which aims to strengthen economic ties between partnering nations in the Pacific Rim by slashing tariffs and fostering trade? Why or why not?
No, I actually am against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think there's a lot of very problematic provisions in the Trans-Pacific Partnership in that it feels like there's a number of provisions that give too much power to corporations that would actually undermine the sovereignty of our own government. Also, I find it problematic that many of the provisions were drafted largely in secret without congressional approval until without any congressional oversight until very recently. Many of our members in the House of Representatives, many of our senators, had no idea what was in the trade bill being discussed. And I find that very problematic. If our Congress is supposed to vote on such bills, I think it's very important that they know what's in it. There needs to be transparency in this process. And unfortunately, instead of having a trade bill written by our Congress, it seems to have been written by private corporations. And when we're looking at trade deals overall, I find some of our past trade deals, such as the North American Free Trade Agreement, such as the Central American Free Trade Agreement, while it might have increased trade, I think it has actually hurt the American workers, hurt workers abroad, in that there are no labor protections, there are no environmental protections, there's no wage standards in those laws, and it has forced our workers in our nation to be forced to compete with brutalized child labor in the third world in sweatshops in filthy conditions. And that has led to a number of corporations closing up shop here and moving abroad where labor is cheaper. And it's a race to the bottom. And I think we need to have fair trade deals that protect the interests of our workers and their workers, and not only free trade deals.
Senator Lee.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is an international trade agreement. In the abstract, I'm very supportive of free trade. Free trade is good. It's good for consumers because it gives consumers access to more affordable products. It's good for manufacturers, including manufacturers right here in Utah, and to farmers and to other businesses who transact internationally, because it gives them access to new markets. When reviewing this or any other trade agreement, I have that as my central inquiry. What will this do to promote free trade? Will it do more to promote free trade than restrict it? And is there any other reason to oppose it? For example, will it subject American policymaking authority, and with it American sovereignty, the free will of our democratic republic, to some international tribunal of people who will be making decisions? With the Trans-Pacific Partnership in particular, this requires a lot of study, because the thing is more than 5,000 pages long. I completely agree with Ms. Snow that there has been a problem with transparency in this document. A few months ago when I went to read it, it wasn't yet public. I had to go into this underground bunker underneath the Capitol in order to review it. I couldn't take any parts of it outside of the Capitol, and it wasn't subject to public disclosure. It's now out. I'm reviewing it, but again, it's only over 5,000 pages long. If it does, in fact, promote free trade, and if it doesn't diminish American national sovereignty by subjecting U.S. law to an international tribunal, I can support it. But my decision's not made on this one yet.
Thank you both. You've been very good at staying on time. And so we're going to go to the next question. It'll be our last question, and it'll be a 45-second answer. Mr. Jamieson, Stephen Jamieson will ask the question.
What would be the most important message about our country that you, as a United States senator, would share with a Utah fifth grader or high school student studying American history?
This one goes to Ms. Snow first.
I would say become involved in in current events, pay attention to what's happening in your country. And as you get older, pay attention to the political process. There's a problem currently with my generation, millennials. We are the largest voting bloc, but we are not actually exercising our power proportionately. And I think it's very important as they come of age that they become active citizens and vote and be involved politically. And that is the message I would like our young people growing up to have. I want them to be civically engaged. I want them to pay attention to how government works.
Senator Lee.
The single most important message I would have them focus on is the U.S. Constitution. This document, written by the hands of wise men, raised up by Almighty God to that very purpose, has fostered the development of the greatest civilization the world has ever known. It's done this by limiting government power, not just because we want small government or weak government. No, it's because we want strong citizens. The U.S. Constitution is often misunderstood and too seldom read anymore. It's not even taught as much as it should be in schools. Its two most important features are that it limits power in two ways, by keeping power close to the people and making sure that power is exercised only by their elected representatives. If we learn and read the Constitution and come to understand it as a people, we'll be better off as a result.
Thank you for those motivational statements. We are approaching the conclusion of this hour. We have time remaining for each candidate to present a one-minute closing statement. Just before the debate, it was determined that Senator Lee will speak first.
Thank you very much, Dr. Magleby. And I want to thank also the Utah Debate Commission and BYU for hosting this event. And I also want to thank my opponent, Ms. Snow, for being here. This has been a great discussion. Today, six of the wealthiest counties in the United States are in the Washington, D.C. area. Now, this is an area that manufactures basically nothing. It's not a technological innovation hub, and it's not the home of any vast collection of natural resources. The wealth is there only because the power is there, concentrated in the hands of Washington elites, elected officials, and government bureaucrats. I'm asking for your vote tonight for the very same reason I asked for your vote back in 2010, to allow me to serve the people of Utah by working to dismantle the concentration of power in Washington, D.C., and to restore the separation of powers put in place by the U.S. Constitution. I'm running to put power back to where it belongs, in your hometowns, your neighborhoods, your families, and your communities. I'm running so that I can return power back to you. Thank you very much.
Ms. Snow.
All right, thank you very much for hosting this debate. And again, I'd like to also thank Mike Lee for debating with me. This has been a great privilege, and I hope that you understand that there are some key differences between Senator Mike Lee and I. I am a working class person who has lived my entire life in Utah. I will represent working class issues. There's a number of issues I would have liked to have talked about that didn't get brought up. I think when we talk about like protecting women, and I'd like to point out that Senator Mike Lee voted against the renewal of the Violence Against Women Act in 2013. He also blocked aid to Flint, which is forcing children to drink water contaminated with lead and to bathe in water contaminated with lead. I would have liked to have had an opportunity to discuss those issues. They weren't brought up in the debate, but I find Mike Lee's actions on those two topics to be very problematic. And I think we need somebody who wants to protect our most vulnerable citizens, including our women and children. And I will be such a senator. You have more power than you realize. You have the power to elect a working class person who will represent working class people in the U.S. Senate, and I would encourage you to exercise that power. Thank you very much.
My thanks to Mike Lee and Misty Snow for their participation this evening. They are candidates for the United States Senate. Thanks to those who submitted and asked questions. Also, a special appreciation to the administration, faculty, staff, and students of Brigham Young University for hosting this event on their campus. The Utah Debate Commission reminds you that the next debate will be at 6 p.m. on Monday, October 17th, from Weber State University in Ogden. That debate will feature candidates for Utah's first congressional district. If you'd like to attend that debate, or the final debate in this series featuring the third congressional district candidates on October 19th, or if you have a question you would like to have submitted for consideration, please visit the Utah Debate Commission website at utahdebatecommission.org. There you will also find a video archive that will contain this and all of this season's debates. We invite you to exercise your right to vote on or before November 8th. For the candidates of your choice in Provo, I'm David Magleby, wishing you a good evening and inviting the live audience to join me in expressing appreciation to the candidates.